As they come up, I think this is will really put this conference, bring it together, answer some questions. You have met Jeffrey Hawkins just now. Jeff, come on up. I've known Jeff for 2-3 years now, and I do enjoy the information he has on his website. We introduced John Cook this morning. Come on up, John. Who we have not met is Rao Williams. Rao began his career with United States Probation System in 1988. In 1998, he was promoted to Senior U.S. Probation Officer, specializing in gangs, organized crime, and terrorism. He's currently a member of the Federal Bureau of FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, United States Attorney's Anti-Terrorism Advisory Council for Missouri, and he's also with the Missouri Domestic Terrorism Intelligence Work Group, and it just his list goes on and on. Rao and his family attend New Community Church in Wildwood, Missouri. He is the chairman of the New Community Church Safety and Security Committee and is a member of his men's ministry. So we're glad to have him up here on our podium. And then our other person is Bill Kakara. I have known of Chief Kakara for 20-plus years. I worked in an adjoining police department, but I know of his reputation, his stature in the community, not only as a Christian gentleman, a father, a law enforcement officer and commander. But I know him and others that work with him. I don't know of anybody in the United States that knows more about crime prevention and areas that surround that than Chief Kakara. And he wrote the book on it. He teaches it. Police departments from around the world want to listen to him. So we're glad to have Chief Kakara with us this morning. I have a list of questions here. We'll either answer them as a group, or if you don't mind, I'll probably ask them individually. But if one of you all up here on the podium has a better answer, just chime in and we'll get started. All right. One of the first questions that I have is, please comment on how a security leader might convince his elders of the need to implement a security safety program in their church. Jeff, let's start with you.
Good question. If I knew that, we'd have triple the amount of people here that we have. I mean, you know, that's one of the biggest problems we have is, and I've said this at my talks this week, is it's getting over that it can't happen here mentality. And you know, and that was one of the reasons why we put all the crimes on our website, was because a lot of pastors that we go to, when we talk about, hey, did you know in the last year there's been 12 homicides in Christian churches? There's been 38 other violent attacks. There's been over $100 million in losses in property. And these things are happening all over the place. Most of them are just not aware. They're not aware of that at all. So, you know, one of the things I just heard from one of the head of security from one of the large mega churches out west this week. And he was telling me about our newsletter. He was talking about our newsletter. And I said, do you give that to your staff, your security staff? And he said, no. He says, I give it to our pastors every week. He says, because they need to see every week what's going on in churches around the country, because they live in a different world. They don't know. So it's a tough nut to crack.
All right. Any other comments?
I just say that you not only have that problem in churches, but you have the problem with agents and officers falling to that immunity zone thinking that this can't happen here. And you do that, as Mr. Hawkins said, you do that by education. And we live in an affluent community in West St. Louis County, and that is a prevailing attitude. And it's just education. And if you also have to keep your team up to speed, keeping them online, because they've counted the ceiling tiles any number of times during their tour duty, the threads in the carpet, and you have to also work very diligently to keep them aware as well. And it's just, I think it's a you have to obtain the confidence of your leadership, and then follow that confidence up by the leadership skills that were highlighted yesterday.
We need to pray.
Absolutely.
So, I think one other variable that you might want to try to utilize is, from a selfish standpoint, the church may be able to get reduced insurance premiums with emergency management planning and having security hardware. So you could try to approach it from a self-interest that we could save money by implementing some of these policies that we talked about this week.
You know, along those same lines, I was touched earlier this week by Jason. That's your, right. Is that your, Jason is with a church in Evanston, Illinois, or Evansville, and he's blessed by their church is just growing. God is just placing numerous people, new people in their church. And I think he has that deer in the headlight look where his pastor sent him here, and I think you told me you were a little overwhelmed. So I hope maybe things have opened up for you. But that was a good question. I don't know if you wrote it, but I hope that maybe will help you guide your church, because I was really impressed with what you had to say. All right. The next question I'll give to Chief Kakara, because I know you where you go to church, and I know of your experience being the chief of a 600-man police department. How do you handle a disruption during a church service?
First and foremost, you have to be prepared. You can't just respond when the incident happens and, you know, say, oh, we got a person and it's standing up there yelling and screaming. You have to have a plan. You have to practice that plan, and you have to be able to implement that plan. It's almost a seamless approach. If you're not prepared, you could have all kinds of trouble. If, you know, one usher approaches one way and another usher goes another way, or what I hear a lot of times, and it just makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, is that, oh, we're okay, we have a policeman that's out front, he's directing traffic, and we'll just call him. Well, you know, I've been the policeman for 30 years, and my training is not based on church. It's based on community, and you don't want that police officer approaching that person as he would as a nightclub. So you have to have policies and procedures and training for your police officers that may be out directing traffic, and that is your foolproof plan. Is, oh, well, we have an FBI agent that goes to Churchill, and he'll take care of it. They may not respond the way you want them to respond, so you have to be prepared.
You know, and I would just add to that, Bob, about, you know, all of us in this room come from a different state, and this is the one thing that I stressed in my session. You better know the law in your state before anybody puts hands on anybody of a disruptive subject, that you have the legal right to do so. If you're not a sworn police officer and you have an usher volunteering or something else, and this guy is just being disruptive, which in some states is just a disorderly conduct, and you put your hands on him, you've now committed a battery. And if you restrain him, you might be arrested yourself. And so that's a liability for the church. And that talks to what the chief was talking about, is that, you know, you got to talk about these things well ahead of time. But you better know what the laws are in your state. Every state is different. Three states in the United States don't even have any laws that govern security. None. They have none on the books. And some states are so overregulated that, you know, if you have church security, you may be violating the law just by having church security if they're not properly registered and trained by your state standards. So before anybody starts putting hands on anybody or doing anything, you better really make sure that you're within the bounds of the law within your state, or, you know, nothing would be more embarrassing than to see one of your ushers being hauled away in handcuffs because they grabbed somebody and they didn't have a legal right to do so.
Yeah. Raul, I'll ask you this question. It's been suggested that we're at the point of some type of legitimate certificate or diploma or other completed educational program for those interested in church safety and security risk management. How would you proceed, and are you in favor of this?
Well, I'm proud to say that I'm the new kid in the block, because it's been a long time since kid and my name have been associated with each other. But I absolutely, and I think any such program has to be based on the recognition and utilization of the people that have been doing this for 10, 15 years. Mr. Chadwick and any number of individuals, because when we started our security program, we went to our brothers out at Grace Church in Los Angeles, and it was a fabulous experience. I think, given the demand for this issue, I think some type of standardization and some type of curriculum would be exactly what we would need. If I could send some of our team members to this, would be fabulous. And I'm in favor of some form of standardization and certification.
Anything else?
Just ditto that. It's one of the things I mentioned earlier. It's just the curriculum is so important. But also having a university, seminary, what have you, that has credibility to bring to the table, that gives that certification, legitimacy. And, otherwise people are going to say, well, there's so many, there's just this group in this city and this group in another city, and it's just kind of all varied. And you have to develop, and this was happening in the Homeland Security curriculum when I was DHS, was there was a lot of talk with among the training folks of developing kind of a professional list of the types of courses that you would have, and then have it accredited by whether it was your Southern Association College and Schools, whatever accreditation association in your area. And so I would encourage people to think about, you have good relationships with your universities and Christian colleges and seminaries as well in your particular area, to talk to them about that. If they see the importance of it and they use these statistics that Jeff's talking about, and you convince them of the need for it.
Well, John, let's give you this next question, and I'll preface with this, thinking I know where this question was going. As we have talked earlier, the majority of all evangelical churches, 59, 60, 65% are 150 or 100 members or less. Now, we have seen all the resources that's out there for safety and security. But knowing the mentality of our local pastors, maybe of these small churches, how do we approach our small churches to get this message to them? They're not going to buy into all these websites that they see. How can we get our small churches to buy in to the need that is out there for church safety and security?
I think bringing it home to them, that I think just echoing what Jeff was saying, using some numbers and talking about smaller churches where it's happened. We know of examples all over the country where it's not a real, real large church where it happened, where incidents occurred. And to talk to them about the idea of, it could start with just volunteers. It doesn't necessarily cost anything or much if you need to just start a program. It often starts with volunteers. In fact, I had one of my staff at my church say, once you give it to the staff, they'll mess it up. But, I don't want to say that. I mean, it's not bad. What they're saying is, in the large church, you got this bureaucracy, and you kind of put it into a program, develops a life of its own, but it may not have the passion behind it because that staff person has all these other things that they're dealing with. And so if you really start with a volunteer mindset of, we've got people that are retired police officers, Navy SEALs, what have you, that have this great experience, and you've already got some people on board that you've talked to about it that you can bring to the table, I think that makes a big difference, as they think, oh, that's not anything that I have to do a lot of work on.
Start over
with something, fresh. It's just that this is already developed for me, and I just say, give my blessing on it, go.
Anyone else?
I also think it's imperative, and what we have spent a lot of time doing is training local police officers that are part of the communities that have the small, the rural churches, the churches that may not have a wealth of resources, to have the police officers cognizant of the risks that churches face and how to help the pastor and the church volunteers initiate that type of action. And it doesn't need to be overly complicated. It's one of the things that I want to stress to you all today. Is church crime prevention does not have to be overly complicated. For those who was in my class, we've seen that the vast majority of crime in churches occurs because someone left the door and a window open. So if we could just get the church to close the doors and lock the doors and lock the windows and be secure, we're going to cut down a lot of property crime.
Great. I think you're dealing with the issues of stereotypes pastors may not be that familiar with the law enforcement community, but I've had the honor of being involved in the law enforcement community for 28 years, and you have some of the most dedicated professionals. They don't do it for salary. They are professionals in terms of planning, contingencies, and they carry out the most enormous monumental task with all the ease, and little or known is seen. And there are ways to approach people to deal with the question we dealt with earlier. We, you know, all law enforcement officers aren't the same, and we have our fair share of folks that they can start a fight in an empty room. So that's not the person you want to make an approach in a high profile case. But an elder said to me just a couple of weeks ago, he says, I'm amazed at the professionalism that I see in law enforcement and the responses and really where that has how far we've come in 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah. And you know, one of our successes that we have found is the way the Christian Security Network does training is we don't go rent out a Holiday Inn somewhere and say, hey, everybody come to us, you know, and then try to get churches to come to us. The only way that we do seminars is when churches invite us out to their community, and we partner with whatever church. And we've been in big cities, and we've been in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you know, where I think we aren't going to get a church come to the security seminar, you know, but by partnering with the church in the community, they know their pastor knows all the other pastors of all the small churches, and they say, hey, you really have to come hear this message. Send your deacons, send your elders, you come, whatever the case may be. And that's how we do it is, you know, we put the burden on the church to reach out to their community because we don't know their community. And like you said, they don't know Jeff Hawkins or Chuck Chadwick or anyone else, but they know their own church. And people don't even know who's coming in and doing the training, but they just know their church is hosting it and bringing it. So, you know, we go anywhere. I mean, anybody that wants us to come out and do a seminar, we'll go out anywhere and do it if they can work with their area churches and ministries to bring people in. And that's been a good way to reach out because it's not us reaching out as the experts. It's the church reaching out to the church community.
Sure. All right. Good. Thanks. And I'll start with Jeff on this one. You just touched on it briefly in your presentation, and it says, what information is available on background checks and how extensive? Just give us a brief overview no matter what size. Whoever wrote this question, I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit. The importance of it, regardless of the size of your church, and how do you start that?
Yeah, I mean, people are, and if you read the book, we have a section on background checks and talk about the various laws. But churches are really amazed when we go in, whether they're really small churches or really large churches, when we tell them, you have to background every single staff member and every single volunteer that's connected with your church or ministry. Not only for the protection, the obvious protection of bringing somebody in that's a possible threat, but the liability that you have. You know, we've documented, again, if you go to our website and you read the crime report that we put out, we've documented cases. There was a case recently in Boston or Baltimore where and this is what we hear all the time, pastor hires somebody, hey, you're a part-time maintenance guy, you seem like an okay guy, you're not going to be here when anybody else is here, so, you know, it's not like you're going to be handling money or you're a big threat, you're just cleaning the offices during the evening, so I can you know, hire you part-time and I don't need to do a background check on you. About a month later, this person molests an 11-year-old girl in the church who happened to be there with her mom when her mom was doing some volunteer work. The police arrest the guy, find out he's a convicted sex offender. You know what the liability of that church is by bringing that convicted sex offender into that church and not doing a background on him? Because the argument is, you know, well, he was only part-time and he wasn't going to come in contact with any kids anyway. Well, he did. You know, and we see this all the time. We see this with internal thefts. We see this with sexual assault cases. We just had a woman in a church brutally raped, a church secretary, by somebody that the pastor brought in to do some extra work and never ran a background check on him. And the guy was a convicted felon. Everybody needs to be background. And it's not as it can be very complicated if you try to do it yourself. but we partner with organizations that can walk you through it and take all the legalities out of it. So, you know, again, dig into it a little deeper, learn about it, but just know that you have to background every staff member and every volunteer, regardless. And I know it's going to cost. Everybody goes, oh, you know how much it's going to cost? Yeah, it is. And the $9.99 internet searches that you can go do is not a background check. We have taken convicted felons that we know and run them through those $9.99 background checks on the internet and come back with no criminal record. You're wasting your money. If you're paying $9, you're wasting your money.
Chief?
What I like to add on that, and no one is ever going to say, don't do a background check, because it's paramount. It's the first step that you should take when you have volunteers and employees in your church. But don't think it's a silver bullet. There's a high percentage of pedophiles that have never been convicted, so they're not going to show up on your background check. So make sure that you have other policies in place, a six-month rule, the two-adult rule. You have to make sure that I've seen a lot of church administrators say, well, we did background checks, so we're okay. It's only going to show people that have convictions. You want to check with their previous church. Why did they leave? What other experiences did they have in the church? See, do a little bit further digging. And make sure if they're going to handle money that you do a credit history check on it. You don't want anybody counting your money that's facing foreclosure or bankruptcy.
And plus, background checks are not a one-time thing. When I go into churches and I ask the senior pastor, how long have you been with the church? 17 years. When was the last time a background check was done on you? 17 years ago. You know, it's like, well, you know, and we see, again, these incidences happen all the time. It's like the chief was saying, you know, you got a church secretary or treasurer that's handling your money. You maybe run a one-time background check on that person, and then 6 years down the line find out that person's been embezzling, you know, $500,000 from your church, and you never ran another credit check on that person. And if you would have, you would have seen maybe the debt going up or the debt going down, but some change in that credit history that would have thrown up a red flag saying, hey, this person's handling my money. How did you overcome $40,000 in debt over 1 year? You know, I mean, did you win the lottery? Did you inherit something? But you're handling our church's money. We need to know. You know, that's what background checks will do.
Great.
Another resource, yeah. I'll mention that he was here speaking, was David Millbrook. I think you all, a lot of you met, but as far as legal issues and kind of going through that web, and he's listed in your brochure and everything. But that was one of the things we talked about in his seminar that I attended, was the background checks, but then the child molestation, and then the people that are on those, you know, the lists and all that. You know, it's not one of the things that he mentioned was that people that are on these lists with some sort of sex offender list, I guess, mm-hmm. and you can find it on the internet or wherever you find. I mean, there's not really any gray area. It's kind of a yes or no thing. And what's unfortunate about that is that you may have had somebody, you know, that was pretty young and, say, dating a 16-year-old girl, and you know, they messed up, but the guy's, you know, maybe 10 years later, he's still on that list, and it's a really tough web to untangle because this person has since been redeemed, and you know, you want to be about that redemption and all, but what he was talking about is making working with, he's actually doing some lobbying work and some working with the federal government on trying to in other states to change the laws a little bit to make that a little more flexible as far as having different levels of you know, sex offender list and stuff, so that there's not just this, you know, you've got this mark on you for the rest of your life, and people do in the church, of course, in the Christian church, we want to be about redemption and so anyway.
I think you make a good point. There certainly are levels and degrees of sex offenders. Mm-hmm. But I think, as Ron and I had talked this morning, the critical component of that is communication. Because mm-hmm. we're dealing with an issue in my career right now with a person that has expressed coming to know Christ while in prison. Mm-hmm. And we're in communication with the senior pastor, the associate pastor, the director of security, as well as the youth minister, and we're as well as the sheriff of that particular county, so that we're all on board. We all know this is how this is going to work when this person is integrated into worship as well as into some pastoral counseling. So
that's great.
I think that's a good approach.
And that's what makes unique the church is unique, because that would never exist in any other type of venue.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and there's so much hysteria media-wise and surrounds that issue. That, you know, people think, you know, if something happens later, then you definitely are liable, and so it's something you gotta watch. Yeah, it's good.
Good. A couple of good questions I think we'll close up with, but I'm sure most of you all will want to comment. Can you project, based on current trends, where Christian organizations and security concerns will be in 10 years, Chief?
Wow.
Good question. Who wrote that?
I think we have made progress in the last several years of raising the consciousness level. Having a conference like this is a clear indication we're going down the right path. Being a 30-year law enforcement person, I'm more pessimistic than optimistic, and I see the violence in our society escalating. Here in Louisville, we have been typically a very congenial community. I see that changing with more and more homicides. It seems like the lead story is almost a homicide a day now. I know it's not a homicide a day, but it seems like that with all the news coverage. I see a more violent community where, you know, we had the Maryville shooting where, you know, someone who just hated God came in and executed a pastor. I'm fearful. I'm fearful. I see us going down from the terrorism aspect. You know, what do Christians represent to others in the community? What we believe. You know, we talk about bombings at high-profile venues, but if someone walked into Ron's church and blew themselves up, that would be on every newscast in America for a week. That would be a high-profile type of crime. And I think what we represent in the evils that are out in the world, I think that puts us in peril. I think we need to be on guard, and I think if we have this next year, I hope that there's 300 people here, and then a year after that, 900 people there, because we're going to need to be on our vigilant toes.
Just to dovetail on what the Chief said, we see that in St. Louis as well, and another disturbing trend is the age of the kids out there with guns and the lack of remorse. And not too many years ago, if you were out there doing your business on the street and you encountered a 14-year-old kid, go on your way. Well, now you better be prepared to deal with that kid as a potentially armed individual. And then you introduce into that mix our faith, which has absolutes, and this particular individual comes face-to-face with an absolute standard that God sets. That causes, how do you respond to that? Well, typically, in a street world, you respond to that in a violent manner. And if a church is in a community preaching the immutability of God's word, you're going to become a target just by the very fact that you're holding true to biblical standards.
I'll just add that I think in the next 10 years, I'm hopeful, again, that we'll continue these discussions. I think raising the level of awareness is the first, you know, level that we need to go to, and then it needs to be kind of a training, imparting knowledge, partnerships working across the board with others, like-minded people, and then I think you will see more of that, and partly because of the awareness of the incidents that have occurred and it happening closer to home or whatever. So we're in a fallen world, as we know by reading our scripture, it's not going to get, things aren't going to get better in the short term. But one of the things that we can do is just to continue to pray and work together. fellow believers.
You know, I'm going to just off the cuff ask a question here that Jeff, you brought up in your presentation. Were I'm a member of AS-IS, American Society of Industrial Security. I have attempted to become a CPP, but haven't had the guts to take the test yet. But you mentioned that, and I saw it, that you're now on that committee or chairing that committee for all the multiple faiths. How do you balance that when some of the faiths actually are threats against others? How do you balance that?
Very carefully.
Okay.
I've been involved with ASIS for 22 years now, and I've been in a leadership position for 10 years. And about 3 years ago, I realized that ASIS was not addressing faith-based organizations. They address every other sector, you know, hospitality and chemical industry and all these other industries, but they really weren't doing anything for faith-based organizations. Obviously, selfishly, I was concerned about the Christian community, but cannot go to somebody like ASIS, just like you can't go to the government and say, hey, I just want you to concentrate on the Christians, you know, even though we are the vast majority in the United States and everybody else is on their own. So, you know, I had to approach it to put together a faith-based organization security committee. And then I had to, when they approved for me to go ahead and do that, I had to reach out to all the different faiths to have representation on that committee. But I'll tell you something. I knew some people personally, like from the Anti-Defamation League and the Jewish community, and Greg Dunn and the Church of Latter-day Saints. Who I'll tell you something. The Mormons have an unbelievable security program worldwide that rivals our own State Department. I mean, they have it all together. But you know, when it came to the Muslim community, who do you reach out to? You know. And so I started tapping the shoulders of federal agencies that I know, saying, you know, I don't want to bring somebody on that has terroristic ties or has made statements against what we're trying to do here. And we actually came up with good representation from the Muslim community. And it's one of those things. I think everybody is kind of leery of everybody else at that point on the committee. But you know, our world is what it is. You know, my goal, again, selfishly as a Christian, my goal is that we have this committee of all faiths, but at some point we break out into our own separate faiths so we can form our own working groups. And it's kind of like what you were saying, Earl, about certification and best standards. I mean, there is the CPP designation, which is, if you're not familiar with it from a security standpoint, The Certified Protection Professional, CPP, is the longest standing, most recognized security professional designation out there. I'm hoping that we can develop best practices and standards for churches and develop some kind of certification program along those same lines. And that's why we're working with ASIS on doing this, because it doesn't matter what the Christian Security Network says, it doesn't matter what Southern Baptist says, it doesn't matter what any other organization says. You know, you need somebody that's been around for a long time and is recognized in the law enforcement and security community. So that's how we are working. But it's a delicate balance. I mean, it's a delicate balance. You know, the people that I work with in the Muslim faith, I mean, they know I have a DVD here that talks about radical Islam and what a threat it is to us. If you were at my terrorism talk two nights ago, I don't make any bones about it that our greatest threat out there from you talked about what's the growing trends that face our church. We're going to face growing crime trends just because churches are easy targets. That's, you know, all the other targets have hardened themselves over the last 10 or 20 years. You can't walk into a mall or a corporate office building or a zoo or anywhere else without having security people, cameras, alarms, card access, and all those measures. But you can walk into over 75% of the churches and they have nothing. So your average criminal is going to pick the softest target. But also, there's intelligence out there that is indicating that things are going to enter our shores and they are going to target religious organizations at some point. When I trained in Israel, an Israeli defense commander, before I left, sat me down and he said, you see how we have to live every day. He said, it's taken us 40 years to secure our synagogues and our shopping malls and our schools and our universities. He said, and we've shed a lot of bloodshed learning this. He said, now the question is, what are you going to do in the United States when it hits your shores? And it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I believe that. And I said that in my talk. The first time that a Christian church or ministry has a terrorist attack, every one of your churches and ministries is going to come to you and say, what are you going to do to protect us now? And if you're not ready to stop the crackhead from breaking into your church through open doors and windows and everything, you're not going to be ready to stop a terrorist attack. You're just not going to be ready. But if it comes to our shores, we're going to have to face that.
Good, thanks. I hope I didn't put you on the spot, but great. Thank you for sharing that. Listen, maybe in closing, right, let's ask one more question and start with Chief Kakar and see if all of you want to chime in on this. As we go back to our churches, as we go back to our mission organizations and groups, what do you see as our biggest threat against our churches and churches of any size, if you had to pinpoint something?
I would say consciousness, because we have to be prepared for the crackheads, as Jeff has said, and also the terrorists. We talked about earlier smaller churches not being represented or not being involved. Church security, church crime prevention is for all churches. It doesn't matter if it's 10,000 or 10 people. We have to raise the consciousness level. This is a great turnout, but in reality, there should have been 10 times as many people here. So we have to raise the consciousness level.
Thanks, Ralph.
I would agree with the chief 100%. Complacency in our churches, but it's also those that choose to either head a church security program or become involved in a church security program. You've got to step it up a level. There's a certain level of professionalism that requires you, and those of you in law enforcement know that you have to set your own preferences aside to protect the community and to do the job. And I think sometimes individuals that may want to get involved in church security, they forget about the sacrifice. When we have a new person come on our team, it's very clear, this is a ministry of sacrifice. You're not going to be highly visible and applauded. You achieve your job when nothing happens, or if something happens, nobody knows about it. There is no disruption.
Good point, John.
I won't say the greatest threat necessarily, because I'm not a statistician on all this, but I would say that one of the greatest threats we have is the people from within our community as well, not necessarily somebody coming in from the outside, because I think there is a complacency develops. It says a lot about accountability within the church that we've kind of lost hold of, I think, in a lot of ways. And our churches get larger, and we just get complacent about that. But accountability for really knowing the people next to you in the pew, and the people that come to your classes and your Bible studies, and knowing their, you know, their past, get to know them. I mean, not in a you know, like a law enforcement inquisitive way necessarily, but just kind of. To know more about each other. I think it helps with accountability. It also helps bond relationships. But I think we need to know more about the people next to us. And then we may be able to pick up on some type of behavioral changes that they may have. And I know there's lots of training you can do on that, on not just with security people, but other leadership within the church, so that we can just have more knowledge and awareness of what happens. If you're talking about the finances, that's one thing that you can be aware of, but there are lots of other behaviors just to look for. So.
Yeah. Jeff? And I think the greatest threat is ignorance. And I don't mean ignorance in a bad way. I mean ignorance in not knowing and not really understanding what security means in a Christian environment. And that's the biggest thing that we have. When we talk to pastors, they think security is all about guards and guns and metal detectors and cameras. And I always tell them, you know, look up the definition of security. Security means to be free of fear and anxiety. And isn't that what you want your church really to be, free of fear and anxiety? If your people are going to church and they're worried about, is somebody doing something to my child in daycare? Is my car being broken into in the parking lot? Who just walked in the back of the sanctuary? Do they have a gun? They're not worshiping in peace. So by not doing anything, you're not offering that sense of security. So it's really the ignorance that is our biggest threat. We're our own worst enemy by not doing anything. So become aware and informed, and make those around you aware and informed.
Well, in closing, let's be conscious. We need to be held accountable, and we need to get our head out of the sand.